Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
That thing is on.
Awesome, awesome. Here we are.
Here we are after after a bit of a delay. Another edition of the bandwagon. You know, other things happen. And
so many things.
Lots of things.
So
but
many things. You were sick, too, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
You kind of got sick. And I'm working on a mini documentary, and it makes it really hard. So, but we're here today. And I have to say, we're in the studio that we've often recorded in, but it's been remodeled with new equipment. And it's so roomy. I feel real in here.
Yeah, it's we'll call it Palacious Studio B.
Oh, yeah. No, Palacious doesn't even begin to cover it. I don't feel like I'm in a closet anymore. I feel like a closet with windows, as it turned out. But, like, just everything. I feel, I don't know. We could like, stretch, do yoga in here while we talk. There's a lot going on.
More counter space, a brand new board. It's just very cool. Thanks to Walt and the entire team of engineers who've gotten this thing up and running, because it's beautiful.
Oh, yes. And it helps us bring a much better audio product to all of you.
Yes, indeed. There are a lot of things to talk about in this edition of the Bandwagon, so we'll get right to it. I don't know about you, Lisa. I was just having a plain, ordinary, boring little Saturday. Then all of a sudden, we got this announcement that there would be a news conference Saturday afternoon, and it had to do with the future of football coach Bill Cubitt.
Allowing him to continue in that situation, as tenuous as it was, wasn't the most productive use of the next 9-10 months. We have recruiting to do. We have a team to care for. We have a group of people across the way who are very committed to trying to put what has been a very bumpy few months behind us. This decision allows us to start doing that.
That was Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman in his first day on the job, making a huge decision for the future of the program.
Yeah, like, so I too was having sort of a regular old Saturday, and I saw something on Twitter from our friends. Can I call them our friends? They don't even know us, but maybe they know you. Our friends at Champagne Room on Twitter. Somebody had said that their boyfriend's cousin's brother's mom or somebody said for sure that, like, Lovie Smith was coming to the U of I. And Champagne Room reacted like, oh, okay then.
Yeah, sure.
And so did I. I was like, oh, my God, that'd be hilarious. But as the day wore on, by 6 o'clock, it was starting, no one was saying anything, which to me, like, right, you know, you would think if there wasn't a shred of a possibility, they would be denying it or whatever. Like, Lovie be like, no, you know. So the longer that things went on with nobody saying anything, the more I thought, well, maybe this is true.
And the first indication I had that this was definitely a legitimate possibility was I saw a tweet from Ryan Baker with CBS Chicago.
Right.
And those of you who are familiar with Ryan, he graduated from here. He was a manager on the 89 basketball team that went to the Final Four. He is still very much plugged into the athletic department here at Illinois. And he tweeted that sources were telling him that Lovie Smith was going to be the next head coach at the University of Illinois for the football team. And sure enough, Monday afternoon, we got to meet Lovie Smith.
I realize who I am and what people see. And hopefully that'll just inspire more young men to kind of dream big. For me to be in this role, to be the first at anything, is pretty special, and especially a university like ours.
Lovie responding there to a question about being the first African-American head coach for Illinois football.
And that was yesterday. And Sunday, when it was Saturday had gone by and everybody was like, oh, wow, maybe this is happening. And then Sunday, it really just seemed like everybody was just waiting for Monday. And I was outside Sunday evening in our driveway, and I heard a private jet fly over our house like they often do. We're on a flight path from Chicago. And I was like, Lovie's in the air. I bet that's his plane. I don't know if it was. He could have already been here. But it was kind of nice to think about, like, I'm down here and Lovie's up there, but he's going to be landing here. And, yeah, it's amazing. And the other thing Well, there's. I have a lot of feelings about this. As you know, I'm not a humongous football fan, but I think this does amazing things for the university, and it sends a real message. I think that, like, okay, we know things have been in disarray, and Josh Whitman comes in first day. Maybe there were some things along with the announcement. Maybe there was a leak somewhere. Maybe players found out on Twitter before they were told by Whitman or other coaches or whatever. That's a little bit of a flub. It hasn't been. It wasn't a perfect day. But the fact that he clearly did his homework before he even got the position and had a vision for how he was going to start. Now, it's still early. He's, what, this is his third day? It's still early, but I really loved the way that he came in, and he's a man with a plan.
Yeah, very obviously had this plan in place, and I think it's safe to say that if he did not have somebody lined up that he was confident was an upgrade, he was not going to make a change. I think he was he was willing to go through this season with Bill Cubitt as the head coach, which I think would have been fine given the circumstances, but I think he talked about it a little bit there. He didn't want to kind of be in a holding pattern for the next 9 months waiting to see how the next season played out. He had in mind somebody that he wanted as a head coach. And it's very interesting kind of how all these relationships work in athletics, because Josh Whitman played his college football here at the University of Illinois for one Ron Turner, who was the head coach at that time. Ron Turner was the offensive coordinator for the Bears for several seasons under Lovie Smith, when Lovie was the head coach in Chicago, including the year they went to the Super Bowl. Turner was the offensive coordinator that year. So this kind of all came about because you know, Whitman was talking with his former coach, Ron Turner. They still have a very good relationship, and talking about, you know, who are some possibilities for the future at Illinois. And the name Lovie Smith came up. Lovie had been coaching in Tampa for the past 2 years, got fired after this past season. It's unusual for a head coach to only get two seasons in the NFL. And I don't know enough about that situation down there to know exactly what happened. But I do know that after a very bad first season with Lovie at the helm, they only won two games. They went 6-10 this year. They had a rookie quarterback in Jameis Winston who had a good season for them. So it looked like things were up on the upswing down in Tampa. Again, I don't know everything behind it. Maybe there were some things off the field that, that played into it, relationships with ownership, whatever. I don't know. But it looked like Lovie had that thing at least going in the right direction. And I think at the very least, from what I know about Lovie Smith, I don't think you have to worry about anything off the field. I don't think you have to worry about any side issues with Lovie Smith. He's always come off to me as a very class guy, first-rate individual, and everything I've read about him since the announcement, you know, only backs that up.
So I have a couple questions for you. Number one, what does Lovie short? What is it short for?
You know, I don't know.
My husband and I were talking about this, and I would queue up a search for you, but I'm going to let you figure that out while I ask you. The next question is, he was affiliated with a college program in the mid-90s, is my understanding. I've only ever known him as a professional football coach. So my question is, what is he going to bring to the college game now? He's been dealing with pros for a long time. The game has changed, especially in terms of the culture around recruiting and publicity around players and social media and all those things. I have to think, just from seeing the way Josh Whitman has handled this whole thing, that he and Lovie, again, have a plan in place for that, or Lovie is Coach Smith, whatever we're going to call him. I like calling him Lovie. I do.
I do too,
So is he going to be able not just to win games, but is he going to be able to – how is he going to handle his team when things are so different than they were 20 years ago?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think at the very least, I think Lovie will demand respect from the guys who come in here. I mean, they will know that he was an NFL head coach and an NFL head coach for 10 years plus. So I think that alone will certainly garner the respect of a lot of the players in the locker room. This was all secondhand, but reports were that when he addressed the team, when he came to campus yesterday. When he was done, the team gave him a standing ovation.
Dang.
So, I think he's already got their attention. He's got their respect. Now, the question, I have two questions about Lovie Smith at Illinois. One, he's always been a defensive coach. That's his specialty on that side
right,
of the ball.
Right.
He coached under Tony Dungy down in Tampa when Tony was the head coach down there, kind of that Tampa 2 defense, cover 2 scheme. That was a big part of what Lovie does on the defensive side of the ball. The issue a lot of the time with Lovie has been on the other side of the ball on offense.
Mm-hmm.
And with Bill Cuban, of course, leaving, he was responsible for that side of the ball here at Illinois. So I think the most important hire from a schematic standpoint is going to be who serves as the offensive coordinator here at Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some names bandied about, all speculation at this point. I'll be interested to see who he hires there, because I think that's a very important hire for on the field, how they perform. The other part of it is I certainly anticipate him bringing in some people that have coached with him in the pros, but you will also need people on the staff who are in the college game, who have been recruiting in the college game and have some of those relationships established. Are some of those guys holdovers from the current coaching staff? Are those guys from other colleges, which might be challenging at this time of year? Most of the time, by this point, you're dealing with spring football, and all the coaching staffs are in place around the country. Do you start poaching other college teams' coaching staffs here in March, or do you get guys who maybe have been college coaches recently, don't have jobs right now, maybe guys who have recently gone from college to the pros,
mm-hmm,
still
mm-hmm.
familiar enough with the college game to be able to recruit? Some interesting questions to answer there.
For sure. And, you know, just to sort of wrap it up a little bit, too, the fandom here is fickle.
You think?
You know? And, I think the fandom anywhere is probably fickle. You know, and he's like this marquee name, very well known, you know, was a Bears coach, worked in the pros, gives us a lot of credibility, like, at the get-go. But it might take a little while to rebuild, you know? And I'm just hoping that, like, if we don't have that amazing first season with him, that, you know, people don't turn on him. I just, mm-hmm. And I'm thinking too of like Jim Harbaugh coming back to the college game or coming to the college game from the pros. And, you know, expectations are high of these coaches when they come in. And, you know, it takes time to rebuild not just a football program and, you know, some basketball programs, but a whole athletic department. And I do like the fact, again, I think this hire sends a message, and I think A.D. Whitman is also sending a message. Like, his sleeves are up and his hands are already dirty. He's getting it done. So I'm kind of excited to see that kind of leadership coming in to athletics at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly has been an interesting first few days of Josh Whitman's tenure, to be sure.
Yeah, maybe it'll be quiet now for a couple days.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure Josh Whitman's kind of hoping it'll be quiet for a few days.
Give it's him a lot of running around for him.
Yeah,
didn't he
exactly.
take it like a day trip to Tampa, too?
Yeah, exactly. Private jet to Tampa and back, you
yeah.
know. Other news that's come out this week is that Maria Sharapova, testing positive for a banned substance, and that could have some implications not only for her but for Russia and everything else.
Well, I haven't read that far. Again, I make it sound like I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm not on Twitter all the time. I am often on Twitter, but I happen to see across Twitter that Maria Sharapova who is a 5-time Grand Slam women's professional tennis player. In case anybody doesn't know, she's like 6'2" And she makes a lot of noise while she plays. She's just one of the screamers.
And she can't beat Serena Williams.
And it's actually really weird because I was in Meijer that, like, Sunday morning, and there was a little girl who was in a shopping cart being tormented by her older brother, and she was making a very Sharapova-like noise. And I remember thinking, that little girl sounds like Maria Sharapova. That's really strange. But and then later I find out that she had tested positive for a drug that has been recently banned. This isn't like a drug that's been on the books for decades or anything. It's called Meldonium. She tested positive at the Australian Open, where she lost to Serena Williams. And it's a new drug. My understanding is it's a drug that can help with endurance. I'm not sure why she was taking it. not like it's a drug where maybe you've got a heart issue or a regular heartbeat or something. I don't know, but that it aids blood flow. And is not approved for sale in the United States. And she's been taking it for like 10 years. And it just recently became uncool to take.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's not just her. There are probably lots of other athletes who have been taking this drug. And she admitted in her press conference yesterday that she had been taking it. She just didn't open the email. She didn't click on the link where somebody was telling her. I think that's a terrible excuse. She's got coaches and people around her who can work with her. But I was really surprised and disappointed. She's always seemed to be like a really hard worker, and I thought even if she had forgotten or was just being lazy, that was kind of a disappointment as well. And so as a result, though, like Nike was just like, we're done, or we're suspending our relationship.
Right. We're not renewing the contract. I think it was
right. So and that's they're not going to be the. They're not going to be the last ones, I'm pretty sure. So I just that news, for tennis. I mean, I guess I've heard a little bit about how some of the male tennis players, men's tennis players, might be taking the drugs, but not. It's just not something I ever heard about in the women's game.
Yeah. No, me neither. So yeah, too bad about that. Hopefully, she'll be able to get her career back on track. Although. This could have some long-lasting implications for Maria Sharapova. We'll see.
She could. And the thing is she's not a super young player anymore. It's not like she's 21 or 22. I mean, she's approaching 30. She's had lots of injuries. She's injured right now. I don't know that she'll stop playing, but it certainly is daunting not just to come back from physical injuries, but to come back from kind of a PR disaster and maybe people not trusting you and having to subject yourself to constant drug testing and maybe even being suspended for a particular period of time that can really hurt training. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. So,
all right. Well, it is rivalry time, Lisa.
We need music for this. I got to find us some like trumpet music or really intense like bass heavy music. I don't know. We'll have to find some. But yeah, Brian, it's your turn, Brian. And I'm just here to ask a bunch of questions because you're talking about something I don't know very much about.
Well, thought it would be fun to talk a little bit about a boxing rivalry, and I kind of went back and forth on what boxing rivalry to talk about, and this one, it really wasn't that long lived of a rivalry. They only fought one time, but man, what a fight it was. 1985 middleweight championship, Marvelous Marvin Hagler against Thomas Hitman Hearns.
That's right. I forgot the nicknames, but
yes,
they're coming back.
And in fact, Marvin Hagler was so aggravated that people weren't always using his nickname, he legally changed his name to Marvelous Marvin Hagler.
Wow.
That's dedication to a nickname right there. At the time of the fight, listen to the records for these guys. Hagler was the champion. He was 62-2. With 50 knockouts. Hearns was 40-1 with 34 knockouts. And I invite anyone who has never watched this fight, if you have any interest in boxing whatsoever, if you've never watched this fight, pull it up on YouTube. It will not take you that long to watch it because this fight only went three rounds.
Right.
But it was probably about the most action-packed three rounds you've ever seen in boxing history. I mean, the two guys just came out trading haymakers, just blow after blow. Hagler actually looked the worse for the wear after the fight. He had had a cut that broke open right above the bridge of his nose. He had blood all over his face. Hearns didn't look as bad, but he took a punch from Hagler in the third round that ended up being the decisive blow. It was a technical knockout of a fight. And Hearns got up at 9, but he was so wobbly-legged, the referee just waved it off and said, all right, we're done. And a little bit of background. Hagler had been the middleweight champion for a while. He had really come up through the ranks. It took him a long time to get a title shot, and he finally did. And then he held the title for a few years. And Hearns had kind of come up. He had been a lighter weight fighter. He was a welterweight for the early part of his career. And he he was a champion there and then moved up to middleweight and became the number one ranked contender there, which set up this fight at Caesar's Palace. I did not get to see this fight live. It was on HBO before I had cable.
Back in the days when, like, HBO was, if you're paying for a serious business.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. So this was 1985. So I didn't see it live. I remember seeing it at some point, a year or two later, like on ESPN. They, had gotten a rebroadcast of it. And just the action of this fight was just incredible.
So when the fight actually happened, because there was all this media surrounding it, did you listen on the radio or how, or did you read about it in the paper the next day?
I read about it, yeah.
So, because that's the thing that interests me about, when we've talked about other rivalries so far, we've talked about things that have happened a long time ago, and we can go back and look at those moments now with YouTube. But really, like back then, if you missed it, you missed it.
Right.
You had to read about it or find out about or talk about it with, sort of break it down, and you listen to it on the radio. And so it's just really interesting to me how we can sort of revisit all of these rivalries and have this crazy nostalgic moments right now and go straight back to things that we didn't even have access to at the time.
Yeah, and I think if I remember right, I think the fight was on a Saturday night, and I think I saw like some highlights on a CBS sports show like the next day or something. At that point they still did, like, if they had a game or something on, they would have like a little pregame show where they would show highlights of it,
right,
I remember seeing some highlights of it there and just thinking to myself, I mean, I'd seen a few boxing matches on TV, but I'd never seen anything like this. This was just two guys at the top of their game just going toe-to-toe.
So do you think now with boxing is on pay-per-view most of the time, it seems like, and then it's not just, there isn't just boxing anymore. There's been the rise of mixed martial arts and other types of fighting. And I'm sure there are rivalries there, although I know nothing about them. I mean, do you think the days of the boxing rivalries of yore, I mean, when you were talking about this particular fight, we also talked about some other boxing rivalries that we remembered growing up. I don't feel like I hear about it as much anymore.
Yeah, no, you don't. I mean, there are a few fights you'll hear about, like Floyd Mayweather has been in the news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was just like last year.
Yeah, and he fought Manny Pacquiao a few times, which was a fairly big deal, but like, for instance, right now, I could not tell you who the heavyweight champion of the world is.
Do you think that's because does boxing sort of have the same a stigma to it, with head injuries and violence that maybe football did in mainstream culture? I mean, mixed martial arts is also quite violent. I mean, I don't watch it, but I see the commercials or whatever. And so it's not like it's not violent. I just wonder if, like, boxing has been was such a mainstream sport for so long, and so I wonder if that's part of it, or is...
I think it is. I think one thing that really kind of was a bit of a tipping point was I think the public saw Muhammad Ali, who was such a public figure for so long. They saw the effects of all those fights, especially the ones late in his career where he should not have been fighting anymore.
Right.
They saw the effects of those fights. Certainly those did not help him in terms of Parkinson's disease, which he's had for the last 30 years, and it's gotten gradually worse and worse for him in that regard.
Right.
So I think when you see an icon like Muhammad Ali just deteriorate before your eyes, I mean, he doesn't even make public appearances anymore.
Right,
It's just gotten to that point for him. So when you see that, I think that really had an impact on the public's impression of boxing. And then the other part of it, as you mentioned, was everything, all the big fights then were on pay-per-view. And so if you were a poor kid growing up somewhere, where were you going to see a boxing match on TV?
Well, those boxing matches, because I remember in the 70s being a kid and you'd have Wide World of Sports on or something, and we could see boxing.
Yeah.
Like, I remember it, being on and you just see, like, two guys in shorts and gloves, like, and they weren't these huge blockbuster fights with the lights and the strobes and the confetti and all that other junk. I mean, these were pretty bare bones boxing matches that I would see on the sports shows on the weekends on ABC or whatever, network television. So they did show it, but those marquee fights, those big I'm the greatest, no, I'm the greatest kinds of rivalries, like those, I don't know what I was seeing on the wide world of sports.
I think even into the 70s, you were probably seeing those on network TV. I think really the where the fight started going to first to cable, I think was in about the early to the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. A lot of those fights mm-hmm. started going to cable instead of network TV. And then from there, they started going to pay-per-view. I think in the later 80s, early 90s, that became where those big fights went. And they just became a lot less accessible.
Is boxing still a big betting thing? Like, is that, like, are the odds makers always making a huge deal out of those big fights?
I think in certain circles, yes.
Okay.
But again, I think a lot of, you know, kind of the guys that were always looked at as, you know, the big predictors of fights, a lot of those guys have kind of gone by the wayside too.
Well, the reason I bring it up, I think I had told you last week, I've been watching this show on Hulu, 11/22/63, which is the Stephen King novel about sort of an alternative history of going back in time and preventing the assassination of JFK. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I don't think I'm spoiling anything here, but in the book, boxing and knowing the results of fights before they happen is a pretty interesting part of the book, at least in the beginning. I haven't read the whole book, and I'm mm-hmm. working my way through the series. But that back in the 60s, that guys would get together in the bars, listen to fights, and make bets. And so it wasn't just like super huge, massive wagers being made like in Las Vegas. It was also part of a neighborhood culture, too, where, you know, guys would go down to the bar. You know, generally their wives or spouses didn't come with them, and they would listen to the fights and make little bets, and that was their night out.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I think, and I was trying to remember, I was talking to somebody about the show we were doing, and they said to me, yeah, you know, I remember hearing the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas fight, which was like in 1990, 91, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing that fight on the radio. And I was thinking to myself, you know, even as a kid growing up in the 80s, I don't really remember hearing boxing matches on the radio very much. I think even by then that had kind of gone by the wayside a little bit. But that particular one, for whatever reason, somebody caught that fight on the radio, which is
so they're still doing it even back then a little bit. But I think you'd be hard pressed to find that now, you know, unless it's like a super local fight, which, you know, I have all kinds of questions about, like, what is boxing like now? Because it used to be a way to come up for guys, mm-hmm. much like baseball was
or basketball.
Yeah. And so, and, you know, coaches took on, there's been movies, you know, so I just wonder if it even exists. But I'm looking at the poster for the fight you're talking about, The War.
Yes.
Marvelous Marvin Hagler versus Thomas the Hitman Hearns. And the poster is so 80s, it hurts. Like, it is hilarious. Maybe you can post a picture online. But it's got that huge block print and these, like, sort of oiled up, fierce-looking dudes with the Caesar's Palace logo on them. It's so 80s. I actually remember seeing this. So,
yeah.
I was a junior in high school when that fight happened. So
yeah, and it was a great contrast kind of in styles. Hearns was actually regarded as more of a traditional boxer, stick-and-move kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Hagler was the guy who wanted to turn it into a street fight, basically.
Huh.
And Hearns, and a lot of people think, kind of played into Hagler's hands by fighting the way he did, and Hagler won it in three rounds by TKO. But anyway,
that's fascinating.
A great fight, a kind of a short-lived boxing rivalry. But when I was looking through some different fights and some different things, that one really stuck out to me. So.
Well, that's awesome. I learned a lot during this rivalry segment, which I still want to think up a clever name for it. So I'll have to put my thinking cap on. So
we'll figure it out.
Well, we have lots of other things to talk about, but they're going to have to wait until next time. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned Mike Tyson, so you might be hearing more about him, among others, in a future episode of The Bandwagon. Lots of topics, but who knows what could happen in the next couple of weeks.
Exactly.
I mean, we got sort of derailed by Maria and A.D. Whitman and Lovie Smith. So anyway, but that's going to wrap it up for The Bandwagon. We'd like to thank all of you ever so much for joining us today. It's always a party, and like we always say, there's plenty of room for everyone. Bandwagon is produced by us, Lisa Braltz and Brian Moline. Brian is our technical director. I'm going to call you that now.
Yay.
And our digital dude, because you post all this stuff to the web. I do some behind-the-scenes stuff and promote this thing to the world. Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs, and this whole thing was his idea, so you can let him know what you think, and you can let us know what you think, too. Mike Thomas is our photographer, and he always makes sure to get us on our good side.
Yes.
Our theme song is an R.E.M. B-side. Speaking of sides, I think it's a B-side. Jim Kelly suggested this song, so maybe I should ask him. Or maybe I could ask the Internet. I'm sure the Internet would be happy to tell me. We're still trying to get a bandwagon webpage together. That's what I forgot in that meeting this morning, Brian. That's what I forgot in that meeting this morning. Sorry it's taken so long. You can access all of our previous episodes at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles we discussed, the show notes, maybe a video or two, and maybe a super 80s poster from a fight in the middle of the decade. You can send us feedback. We like Twitter. You can find me at Lisa Braltz and Brian
at Bimoli, W-I-L-O.
We like to talk to our friends.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'll have more in a couple weeks or so. But again, thanks for listening.